When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
Upgrade your laundry routine with a durable and reliable Maytag laundry pair at Lowe's. Like the new Maytag washer and dryer with performance-enhanced stain-fighting power designed to cut through serious dirt and grime. And what's great is this laundry pair is in stock and ready for delivery when you need it the most. Don't miss out. Shop Maytag in-store or online today at Lowe's.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
You're listening to continuing coverage in the Las Vegas Reporter murder trial of Robert Telles from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Did you get that?
The three vehicles being washed, it was just to focus on the one which I know we addressed yesterday in Detective Gaddis' testimony. He was concerned about the anonymous tips, the number of people in reference to the anonymous tips, certain conclusions that Detective Gaddis arrived in, establishing her probable cause, and we would anticipate in basically roughly him testifying to the same thing as had been previously addressed before the court in our motion, in our renewed motion, since my being retained concerning the Franks v. Delaware motion.
Okay, and I do recall reading that report. You're not going to call him first, right?
No.
I mean, so at lunch I can review his report again?
Thank you, yes.
And then make a determination, so I'm assuming the state's making a motion to not allow?
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to be able to review that report again.
Understood, and we have noticed him up as an expert witness. We have him available, and obviously we do this prior to the trial starting to see where the evidence is, the state of the evidence that's been presented by the state. He is available to testify. I've explained the concerns that the state has and perhaps Your Honor would have with his proposed testimony, and we anticipate Your Honor wanting a proffer, but I've provided ahead of time his opinion by way of proffer so the court knows the sum and substance of his testimony.
Okay. And so you won't call him before the lunch hour?
We will not.
Okay.
Sure. Okay. Your Honor, so we were yesterday, after court, we were provided with a series of proposed exhibits. The state has some concerns as to the admissibility as to a number of them. So one of our thought was maybe if we could address maybe some of the issues regarding admissibility now. What I didn't want to do is perpetually interrupt witnesses with objections on this. And certainly if we had to have these a little earlier, we could have at least maybe brought these concerns up.
Who are you? Who's your first witness?
It would be Dr. Mark Chambers. And what we would propose to the court, because this case has been moving forward so efficiently, a number of people are going to be available at the end of the week. We've been reaching out trying to get people to move their schedules to be available today. There's been some difficulties in reference to that. What we anticipate doing is calling Dr. Mark Chambers this morning and then having a break so we could address these issues that should be addressed out of the presence of the jury to avoid an interrupted presentation of the defense's case.
Okay, so you're only going to have one witness today?
Correct. Well, as of right now, we're waiting for another witness. She had called Crime Stoppers She was available tomorrow. We're trying to move her up till this morning. We called the hallway. She is not present yet. Again, everybody was subpoenaed to testify towards the end of the week. So we're trying to accommodate the real-time schedule of this trial.
Okay, so we could let the jury go, but we could deal with some of these exhibits?
Correct.
Certainly.
All right, well, we don't have to do it before Dr. Chambers comes
in.
No,
we can put Dr. Chambers on.
Okay.
Judge, can I have the evidence proposal so I can make a record of what was being objected to?
Right, before, I mean, we could probably do that.
Yeah, the other thing is, I believe the defense will stipulate to the admission of 312 and then 316 to 336.
That is correct, and obviously the purpose of the stipulations is to make the trial process smoother and better presentation of evidence to the jury, and obviously we anticipate participation in the same way from the state concerning our exhibits. But yes, we stipulate the admission of those exhibits. Okay. I'm going to approach your clerk with our defense exhibits.
Okay.
Additional defense exhibits. I believe we're up to X.
So these are the ones the clerk's going to mark.
Correct.
Okay.
So we can make sure. We are, yes, we're on X right now.
And the only other thing, Your Honor, is remember how I talked about having a flash drive of the long form of all the video? Right. The defense raised a couple concerns. I'm just deleting the images they don't want on there to go back to the jury. I want them to check my work to make sure I remove what they wanted, and then we'll be offering that.
Okay. All right, can we bring the panel in?
Thank you. As far as the state's concerned, yes.
All right, we can bring the panel in.
Please be seated.
Does the state stipulate to the presence of the panel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Defense?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr.
Jask,
would you call your first witness?
Yes, the defense calls Dr. Mark Chambers.
And raise your right hand, face clerk.
You do solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in this action shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
You may be seated.
Thank you.
Please state and spell your first and last name for the record.
Mark Chambers, MarkChambers.
Thank you. Dr. Chambers, if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself, beginning with your education.
All right. I Attended undergraduate studies at Stanford University, where I graduated with a major in psychology and a minor in biology. I graduated with distinction, which meant that I was in the top 10% of my class. I also was admitted to Phi Beta Kappa during that time. I also earned a master's degree at Stanford in education. My doctoral studies were conducted at Northwestern University, where I earned a degree in clinical psychology.
How are you currently employed?
I am self-employed with a practice in clinical and forensic psychology.
If you could please explain to us the difference between clinical psychology versus forensic psychology.
Clinical psychology is probably what most people think about when they think about psychology or psychologists. A clinical psychologist deals with problems in the human condition, mental disorders, or other kinds of personal problems people may have in their lives, like depression or anxiety. They do psychological testing to help better understand a person's issues or problems or situation. And then they provide treatment services, which we usually refer to as psychotherapy or counseling.
If you could explain to us, too, a little more in detail what is psychology. I think we all have a pretty general idea, but if we could just address that this morning.
Psychology is the science of behavior. And although most people might think of it as relating to thought processes or something that goes on inside the brain, that's not something that we can access directly with any kind of psychological or scientific methods. So we have to look at people's behavior, and then from that we sometimes infer things about the way that the human brain works or why people behave the way they do. But ultimately we are looking at behavior and then drawing conclusions from that.
In reference to forensic psychology, which you have been qualified in previous hearings to give expert testimony concerning, is it fair to say that psychology is basically taking well-accepted principles, scientific principles concerning human behavior, and applying it to specific circumstances?
Yes, and those specific circumstances are related to some sort of court issue. So a forensic psychologist may do work in family court, conducting evaluations or child custody assessments. They may work in criminal courts like this one here, to provide expert testimony that might help the trier of fact, either the judge or the jury, to understand a particular issue that's germane to the case. Sometimes we also work in lawsuits and provide testimony about maybe in a car accident, what kind of psychological trauma an individual has sustained. But ultimately, as you said, forensic psychology is the application of basic psychological principles and research to the issue at hand in the court-related proceeding. And as a result of that, a forensic psychologist sometimes has to be a little bit of a jack of all trades, because there are a lot of different areas of psychology that can apply to a court-related setting, and so we have to know a little bit about a lot of different things.
Okay, would you kind of, I guess, analogize that to that of a coroner? I mean, a coroner is called upon to give an opinion concerning manner of death.
Certainly, yes. A coroner has to know about head injuries and gunshot wounds and blunt force trauma and poisoning and all different ways of death that somebody might experience. So they can't be an expert in any one of those areas. They kind of have to know all of those things so that when they perform an autopsy, they can bring that knowledge to bear to determine the cause of death.
So we have scientific principles applied to specific fact scenarios that help judges, juries make certain determinations concerning issues of fact.
That's fair to say, yes.
You've given and been qualified to give testimony concerning eyewitness identification. If you could, and other matters, if you could please explain to us other areas in which you have been qualified and given expert testimony concerning.
Sure. One of the big things that I often testify about has to do with the reliability of memory. because a lot of court proceedings rely on the testimony of witnesses, and by virtue of that, the reliability of their memory as to what they observed or experienced or what kind of testimony they're bringing to the court. So there's a lot of research on how memory works, the way in which it can be defective, and that can be helpful to the trier of fact to judge the credibility or reliability of a particular witness's testimony rather than just assuming that whatever they say is automatically true. I've also testified about the effects of various medications or substances on behavior, including drugs and alcohol, because those things can distort the way people behave, the way that they think, the way that they react to certain situations. And so that can be helpful to know. Stressful situations, trauma can also affect a person's behavior and reactions to certain situations. And so it can be helpful for a trier of fact to know more about that before making a judgment about the case in front of them.
And just so I'm clear then, you've been qualified to give testimony as a forensic psychologist. And as a forensic psychologist, your testimony could address a whole myriad of situations that affect people's behavior and why they do things.
That is correct, yes.
You have been called on in prior cases by defense counsel,
yes.
Myself included.
Correct.
Have you been called upon to give testimony as a forensic psychologist in prosecutions?
I certainly have, yes.
Federal cases, state cases, if you could please explain to us just briefly your involvement in prosecutions.
I've testified and consulted all over the world. I think if I had to add them up, the number of prosecution versus defense cases is pretty evenly matched. I've testified in family court. I've testified in civil court. I testified in military and federal courts, as I said, in many, many jurisdictions.
And when you're called upon, let's say, by a defense team or a defense attorney, you are not retained to give a specific opinion, fair to say?
No, I'm here to...
defense-oriented or prosecution-oriented, something like that.
Correct. I'm here to elucidate the relevant psychological principles and research and knowledge that will help the trier of fact better understand case. In some cases, it's not favorable to the party that is consulting me, and I have to tell them, I'm sorry, I can't help you because the research says this, and that's probably bad for your case, and that's okay. I mean, sometimes that means a little loss of work, but I've got plenty of work, so that's not really a concern for me.
In reference to these scientific principles upon which you draw opinions or conclusions, you're not a research psychologist.
I am not. I mean, I was trained in research. I have done research. But in my role as a forensic psychologist, my primary skill is understanding research, being able to read research studies that have been published by other researchers, and then gleaning from that the appropriate principles and understanding about human behavior that's relevant to the case.
And these research studies, again, fair to say, cover a wide array of circumstances.
Correct.
Your job is to review the research. And let me ask you this, the research, whether it be concerning false confessions, whether it be concerning memory, it's open to peer review. And if you could explain that to us.
Sure. So the peer review process is a safeguard to make sure that research that is published has done the things that it needs to do to be reliable. So if a research team conducts a study and then they coalesce their findings and then they put together a paper or an article that they'd like to publish, they then submit it to the journal that they would like to publish it, and then that journal sends the draft of the study to a couple of other experts in the field who then look it over, they critique it, they make suggestions of what things could be done better or questions that they feel like they have that the study doesn't answer that need to be answered in the study. And in most cases then, the study, if the if the editor of the journal feels like there's, it still has merit despite the criticisms, it will send it back to the researchers with the suggestions and say, hey, can you make these changes and we'll take another look at it. Sometimes they'll accept it or reject it immediately, but most of the time it's that middle ground where they try to give some guidance to the researchers on how the paper can be better and more suitable for publication. So by the time a study gets published in a scientific journal, in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, it has been looked over by several sets of eyes, not just the researchers who are submitting the paper.
When you're called upon to give expert testimony concerning issues in the case, sometimes you're called upon to give a wide variety of opinions, and sometimes you're called upon to give a very narrowly tailored opinion as to perhaps a single topic or
subject.
Yes,
I think that's fair to say.
And in this case, you were retained to give testimony in the State of Nevada versus Robert Tallis.
Correct.
Did I reach out to you in reference to this case?
No, I believe that I was originally retained on this case by the defense investigator.
Okay, and that was prior to my involvement, to your knowledge, in this matter.
That's my understanding, yes.
You were called upon to review certain evidence in this case to give testimony concerning suicide attempts for those that are involving charges or facing charges.
That's correct.
Let's talk about this. You know, individuals who may be charged with a crime attempting to commit suicide. How common is it?
Well, first of all, it's hard to say because there's a lot of people that go into custody, but it's not very common. I think it's fair to say that it's probably less than 1 in 1,000 suspects or defendants who are involved in the criminal justice system. So it's not particularly common, but it is more common than it is in the general public. So people who are involved in the criminal justice system do commit suicide or attempt suicide at a higher rate than the general public.
Are there risk factors that have been identified by peer-reviewed scientific research on this issue?
Well, yes. One of the risk factors that has been identified is the severity of the crime, the severity of the charge. So if somebody is accused of a particularly severe charge, then the risk for suicide or an attempted suicide is higher.
Fair to say that the severity of a murder charge is about as serious as it can get.
I would think so.
Is an attempted suicide a reliable indicator of a guilty conscience?
Not necessarily, no.
And is that based upon research?
Yes.
And if you could explain this issue.
So there, in 2011, there was a study published of a very comprehensive research project where they looked at over 27,000 suicides that were committed by individuals who were involved in the criminal justice system. And then they compared those individuals to over 500,000 individuals who were also involved in the criminal justice system but did not commit suicide, so that they could identify, well, what makes these people a little bit different than the people who didn't commit suicide. First of all, I think it probably is obvious that individuals who came in with a mental health problem were already at higher risk because those are the people that typically commit suicide. So it wouldn't necessarily have anything to do with whether they're being charged or not, but it's clear from the research that the stress of being accused of a crime, particularly a severe crime, as I said, can cause people to commit or attempt suicide, whether they're guilty or not. And for the study that I reference, for instance, found that there were people who had gone through the system, were adjudicated not guilty, And after their case was done, they were still at a higher risk for suicide. Other people who had their cases dropped but were still had still been accused of this crime were at a higher risk for suicide. So it was clear from the study that it's more the process of being involved in the criminal justice system, being accused of a crime, that produces the stress that can result in suicide than guilty conscience itself. And I should add, part of the problem that even addressing that question of guilty conscience is that, remember I said earlier about what psychology is and it isn't. It's about behavior, it's not about mental processes. So to accurately answer that question, we would have to know what's in the brain of the individual. Guilty conscience, by definition, regards what's going on inside, not what the person is doing. And so we can't, there are going to be many, many cases where we don't know if the person is guilty or not. So it becomes difficult to answer that question. But we do know that some people, even after they have been found not guilty by the system, just being involved in the system is a suicide risk.
And just so we're clear, you're not called upon to give testimony concerning the guilt or innocence of Mr. Tellis?
No, of course not.
That's obviously within the purview of this jury and not yours.
Absolutely.
So just so I'm clear on your testimony, if a person attempts to commit suicide after being accused of the crime, that doesn't mean that they probably did.
It's not a reliable indicator, no.
Innocent people, or people that have been exonerated of a very serious crime, have attempted suicide.
Yes.
You are aware that Mr. Tellis cut his arms pretty severely in this case.
I am.
Did you have an opportunity to discuss this issue with Mr. Tellis?
I did.
Did he express to you concerns that he had at the time that he did this?
Objections, hearsay.
Was his explanation to you consistent with the studies that you have just referred to?
Objection, hearsay.
It's hearsay.
Again, you have given testimony concerning these studies where a person gets accused, and as a result of the accusation and the process, not necessarily guilt, but the accusation and the process, that person attempted suicide.
Yes.
And that attempted suicide does not necessarily mean a guilty conscience.
Correct.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Thank you. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Can I have some sort of overview of what you reviewed in preparation for your testimony this morning?
Certainly. I was sent the discovery from the case, which I believe included the police report, which essentially documents the investigative process that the police went through when they were assigned to this case. I think that that also included some hospital records for the defendant when he was hospitalized immediately after his arrest because of the injuries to his arms. I think I saw some photos that were related to the case, and I was also provided with medical records for the defendant during his time in custody at Clark County Detention Center.
Okay. And in terms of the police reports, you mentioned that you had we call it the OR, the officer's report. Is that what you're referring to?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. How about any witness statements? Have you reviewed any of those?
I believe there were witness statements in there as well, yes.
Okay. And then did you review photographs associated with the case?
As I mentioned earlier, yes.
Video?
Don't recall seeing any video.
DNA reports?
I think I saw some DNA reports, okay. Yes.
Reports from like phone extractions, anything like that?
More continuing coverage in the Las Vegas Reporter murder trial of Robert Tellez is on the way. From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today, press subscribe now.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it sippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.